Hello, Majority Report freebie listeners. Matt Binder and
Michael Brooks
are here to welcome you to today's show and to urge you to become a member at Majority.fm today. Now, the reason you're getting this plea from us at the top of the show instead of our usual robotic voice is because we forgot
to mention during the show we're going on vacation. Yeah,
we forgot to mention it for you freebies.
For you freebies.
The members
knew all about it because we're closer with them.
So enjoy today's show. It is the last live show of this week. All new content the rest of the week. You will love it. It'll be great shows. We've got that event Sam emceed for Jeremy Hammond and Barrett Brown. Great speakers at that event. I've already listened to a lot of that audio. I wish I went. You'll wish you went too. But you'll be there in spirit by listening to it on this show. And new interviews, some best ofs thrown in there that you might miss actually because you're not a member, but you can get by becoming a member. So we will be back live next Tuesday, a week from tomorrow. Sam Cedar will be back live next Monday, a week from tomorrow. Enjoy.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, August 26, 2013. My name is Matt Binder.
And I am Michael Brooks.
And this is Matt and Mike Mondays on
The Majority Report.
We are broadcasting to you live from the literal but not metaphorical shadow of the New York Times building.
In the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City, we have a great show for you today, folks. Rue Teixeira of the Center for American Progress will join us to explain why we need to raise the minimum wage, why it's ethically right and a political winner, and also the broader issue of rebuilding the Democratic coalition through economic justice, economic outreach. Also, new news from Syria, as it's confirmed, looks more and more likely that the Assad regime is using chemical weapons. Give you an update on that. Also,
the NSA revelations continue. The same NSA revelations that would be impossible without Edward Snowden. These revelations include that the U.S. has been spying on the U.N. If you were an NSA spy and you wanted to find out more information about a girl you really liked, that information was freely available for you to have access to.
Do you really think that this girl, Natalie Chen, is a security threat, Bob?
It's more like her boyfriend. She's cool. But I think the guy she's dating is really questionable. We should check that out.
So we'll go over that.
I mean, it's funny because Michael's actually been saying, we'll talk about this more obviously, but Michael's been using that as, you know, like, how far could this NSA thing go? I mean, it's not just about, you know, national security, and then those people who say that, and then when it comes out where that it's more than national security, has been simply to spy on other countries who are in many of the cases our allies, and then people defended that. And Michael has always gone to, well, what if it goes to an individual spying on someone for their own individual purposes or reason, you know, for their own benefit, whether it be a financial benefit, a love interest. Turns out that is happening.
That's happening.
It's not a worst case scenario. It is the, well,
it's a scenario.
It is
that's
a scenario.
So
that's
we'll
happened.
Go over that. We'll also, Andrew Ross Sorkin last week wrote maybe his most obnoxious column ever, and that's really saying something. So we'll cover that.
Also, in New York, Times, Daily News, Post, all coming out for a certain candidate, and I think it couldn't say more about why to vote for the other candidates.
Exactly. Or the other candidate from the perspective
of this show.
Yes. And also Donald Trump
How did I forget
this amazing university that he set up to help people become more successful somehow was like a scam?
What?
Shocking.
Donald Trump doing something for just the money? What?
So weird. Although, as Trump, according to a really rigorous scientific assessment, there's a 90% approval rating for his school. And we'll get into all of that and more. But first, we're going to take a brief break, and we'll come right back on the Majority Report with Rue Texeria of the Center for American Progress to talk about the minimum wage and more. Thanks for listening to Matt and Mike Monday on the Majority Report.
We are back on the Majority Report. My name is Matt Binder.
And I'm Michael Brooks. And joining us now is Rue Texeira. He is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. Hi, Rue. How are you?
I'm good.
Thanks for joining us. So you have a new piece that you wrote a couple of days ago for Think Progress called Raising the Minimum Wage as a Political Goldmine, where you basically explained why raising the minimum wage is not only the right thing to do sort of morally, it's also kind of a political killer app. It's hugely hugely popular with Democrats and independents, and it even splits the Republican coalition. So could you tell us about that?
Right. Well, one of the most longstanding features of public opinion, and maybe not widely appreciated, is just how popular raising the minimum wage is. And recently they have been asking questions about raising it to $9, which is sort of on the table, and we get this overwhelmingly positive response from the public as a whole. As you mentioned, Democrats and Republicans are really enthusiastic. People with lower incomes are extremely enthusiastic, but so are people with higher incomes. And if we look, actually, even people who say they affiliate with the Republican Party, we find that they're split roughly down the middle between those who support raising the minimum wage and those who do not. And then even more interesting, if we look at working class, white working class Republicans, who are really the mainstay of the Republican Party these days, they're white non-college voters, these relatively downscale members of the Republican coalition are pretty strong in their support for raising the minimum wage, whereas the more affluent, educated part of the Republican coalition is opposed to it. So, you know, you don't have to be a, you know, political strategist on the scale of Karl Rove or David Plouffe to see that that is, you know, a pretty good wedge for the Democrats in terms vis-a-vis the Republican Party.
Absolutely. You know, so I guess to sort of bring it into the present political context, there's sort of two related questions that occur for me, and I guess one is, so President Obama did advocate raising the minimum wage at his last State of the Union. He came out for it pretty strongly, had some very eloquent words, and it doesn't seem like the administration's chosen to kind of take that idea on the road. And I'm just wondering, given the kind of obvious assessment that you just gave, why would that be the case? Why aren't we hearing about this constantly?
I don't have a good explanation for that in a strict political calculus sense. You'd think it would make enough sense that even if it wasn't President Obama's number one favorite issue, that he would still push it because its political dividends are so obvious. It's fits right into the Democratic agenda, as we've been discussing. It doesn't cost money. You know, it doesn't cost, it doesn't have a budgetary implication, which is the big hang-up of a lot of the other things he wants to do. So, you know, one might speculate that moves like this are viewed, at least in some quarters, as being anti-business, and maybe there's some hesitancy there to court that kind of feedback, that kind of blowback from the business sector. But, you know, I certainly think that it's worth the trouble for them to try to do that. When you look at the underlying data, and you look, as I discussed in the article, about how well this even plays in redder states and more conservative parts of the country.
Absolutely.
People just like it. So why would you not push this?
Yeah, it seems really commonsensical. Moving to that redder part of the country, the sort of Republican coalition, it seems to me that an incredible amount of energy has been put, especially in the last couple of years, of kind of bridging that gap that maybe still does exist and is kind of demonstrated through this issue in the Republican coalition, of trying to basically say that to Republican voters that social and economic conservatism were kind of part and parcel of the same kind of moral outlook or package, so to speak. Like you see maybe candidates a couple of decades ago who might not have been, they might have been more kind of solely focused on social issues, kind of bridging extreme economic and extreme social conservatism together, someone like Michelle Bachmann as kind of part of the same fundamentalist worldview. And I'm just wondering, it seems really striking that in spite of all of that effort and all of that work, the minimum wage is still really popular for the same kind of basic obvious reasons that you're articulating, which is that people who don't make as much money understand the need to make more money. It doesn't, it's not that complicated, but there's obviously an effort to kind of reverse that thinking, and it doesn't seem to be working.
No, I don't think so, certainly not in terms of this issue. And you would think that given that, and given the vulnerability Republicans obviously have in this score, that Democrats would just you know, just unleash all the furies they can unleash to try to put that issue in play and really push it. I mean, the Republicans are in some danger of imprinting themselves even worse than they have as the party that simply cares about the well-being of the most affluent and couldn't care less about the fate of most Americans who, you know, have to have a job. They struggle. They try to get by. They're just not into it. Look at all the things Romney said in his last campaign. Look at all the things many other Republicans have said before and since. Look at their, you know, so if you put them in the crosshairs of the minimum wage, that just should worsen their already existing problem. And again, it's a little baffling why all Democrats aren't just sort of pitching in 24/7 to do just that.
Absolutely, and we'll get to that more in just a second. One, I actually just sort of parenthetically, I'd love for you to give a kind of a brief answer on this, because I know that as soon as we have this conversation, this show actually has a sort of small loyal band of libertarian listeners, and Sam regularly puts out a challenge to them and want to sort of come in and debate and call in and debate. And I know some libertarians are just obsessed with this notion that raising the minimum wage would hurt downscale workers and harm the economy. And I'm just wondering if you can give the kind of, you know, the brief debunk of that talking point.
Well, the brief debunk is that, you know, there have been many, many studies done on the minimum wage, and certainly the data are not conclusive that it's any kind of a job killer. And by and large, the employment effects, such as they are, tend to be pretty minimal. I mean, this has been studied in many different ways at many different times, including sort of natural experiments, adjoining states that do and do not raise the minimum wage, what are the effect on jobs and so on. And it just doesn't appear to happen. What happens if you raise the wage floors, yeah, a few businesses will go out of business and weren't very efficient, but, you know, the economy goes on. The economy adjusts. People learn how to use labor that's a little bit is paid a little bit more. Maybe because they do that, they get a little bit higher quality labor, you know, their so-called efficiency wages and so on. And there's a lot of reasons why just raising the minimum wage wouldn't result in catastrophic employment. And, in fact, you know, just keep on raising the minimum wage at reasonable pace, and the labor market doesn't seem to have much of a problem to adjust to that. And just to underscore that in terms of pure economics, there is a regular poll of economists that's done that asked them about policy issues like the minimum wage. The most recent time they did this this poll of economists, those economists actually supported raising the minimum wage, the majority of them, to $9 an hour, and then indexing it to inflation, right? So it keeps on rising.
Absolutely.
You know, these are labor market economists. These are people who study this kind of stuff. And they pretty strongly endorse the idea that the minimum wage, in essence, at this point in the United States, is too low. And we can afford to make it higher. And we can afford to keep raising it so it keeps pace with inflation. So the idea that there's this cut-and-dried economic case that, you know, if you raise the minimum wage, there are catastrophic employment effects is just baloney. It's just, you know, we don't see it in the data. I mean,
right.
We see it in the theory of a certain kind of libertarian, pure free market economics. We see it in the theory. We don't see it in the real world.
Right. Well, as so often with libertarian arguments, it kind of goes back to the old joke about the economist and the engineer and the other guy stranded on an island, and they need a can opener
Let's assume we have a can opener.
Yeah, yeah. Imagine we have a
catastrophic employment effect.
Right.
Now that, you know, we...
Right. Yeah, no, so that makes perfect sense. Now, I want to shift gears getting back into what you were getting to before, which is why aren't the Democrats hitting this issue 24/7? And I think we should mention that you are the co-author of a really, really smart book called Emerging Democratic Majority, which came out in 2002. And if it came out in 2006 or 2005, it would have been like, you know, but you had a couple of years where, because of 2002 congressional elections and 2004 re-election of George W. Bush, there was a kind of like, look at those liberal suckers, you know, picturing an emerging democratic majority.
Right.
But
too late, too early. But what are you going to do?
But what you really did in that book is you mapped out, really, in many respects, what the Obama coalition, what the kind of current Democratic coalition is, which is a sort of growth through a rising Hispanic population, obviously also and other immigrant populations, African Americans, educated and kind of mobile workers across ethnic and economic backgrounds who have a more kind of socially liberal outlook and are more open in some ways to the role of government. And that's really emerged. And I think, though, that what we're kind of seeing now is a kind of fault line in that coalition is that even as there's a real consolidation under Obama of the Democrats being the party of social progress, of marriage equality, of rights for women, and as the Republicans just get more and more crazy and intransigent and reactionary, that fault line's becoming really clear. But, you know, you have made the point recently that there is still a significant portion of white working class voters that the Democrats need to speak to politically, and also, you know, one would argue morally, like people who are experiencing really intense economic stagnation, and no one's really, there isn't really a kind of policy agenda to meet that crisis, or the urban American economic crisis for that matter. And I'm just wondering, do you think that is that the fault line in that coalition now, between the social and economic issues, and what explains that fault line?
Well, I think the key to the coalition's health moving forward is definitely in the realm of economics, because if you can't produce fairly strong growth that's fairly equally distributed, I think it's difficult not only to consolidate the coalition that you do have, the various rising demographics that have powered Obama to victory in the last couple of presidential elections, you know, you run the risk that you won't always be running the margins you are today with these groups, because if you can't deliver for them, if you can't deliver opportunity in a growing economy, just because they like you now doesn't mean they'll always like you. And then beyond that, it's the kind of the problem you were mentioning, that they need a certain, you know, reasonable minority level of support among white working class voters, and they're much less likely to get it if the economy isn't doing well and people aren't doing well within that economy, and that especially applies to these kinds of voters who are congenitally somewhat suspicious of the Democrats in government, not inclined to give it a break, and but they'll feel much better about it if things are going well for them and their families, which is very difficult to do unless, again, the economy's doing relatively well and they're doing well within that economy. So that's why issues like the minimum wage can really be an important part of building that, keeping the coalition together and widening it by including more white working class voters. And conversely, if you're not able to do it, I think you're always vulnerable to blowback from the other side. You're always vulnerable to a white working class revolt against the party. You're vulnerable to attrition and support among, you know, sort of your core constituencies. Everything becomes much easier if you build an economy that delivers for most people. And I think, you know, in Obama's defense, he has made those, sort of sounded those notes much more lately than he has in the past. He seems to be finally off his kick about, oh my God, we got to deal with the deficit, the national debt, we got to be fiscally responsible. You know, maybe too little too late, or it'd be nice if it had at least started earlier. And of course, dealing with the Republican House is nobody's idea of a good time, but nevertheless, I think at least he's talking about the right things now, and I think if he and his party consistently push these kinds of issues and just make no bones about it and aren't afraid to strike a populist note every now and then, I think they'll benefit politically and the country will benefit in terms of better policy. But, you know, first things first, you got to start by saying the right things and pushing the right issues, and then you see if you can make it pay off politically, which in turn leads to greater political strength and the ability to make more good things happen. And hopefully they're on the right road now, and they're going to keep pushing it. But we'll see. We've seen this kind of vacillation back and forth. We've seen the populist Obama followed by the fiscally responsible Obama followed. You know, it's just he hasn't really had a consistent message over the course of his presidency. I think that's fair to say.
Right.
But maybe he's going to be consistent now, and that would be good.
Yeah.
How much would you say, you know, we saw with, you know, movements like Occupy help bring income inequality to the forefront of just discussion. And we have now the growing fast food forward movement where we're about to see this week another fast food action to raise the minimum wage for fast food workers. And this is a growing movement. How much would you say that has been effective in growing the national opinion on being for higher minimum wage?
Well, I think it certainly helps buttress the issue. I think that Occupy was very successful at raising the overall issue of how much inequality there's been, there is, how bad the trends have been, and how it doesn't really have to be that way and shouldn't be that way. I think they were less successful in sustaining themselves as a movement, but that's another discussion. But I certainly think they helped change the conversation, and they did. It did result, I think, in national political forces in and around the Democratic Party being much more attentive to these issues and being willing to talk about them more. Now, you know, that said, it's not the case that there's been a full-fledged crusade on the part of the Democratic Party and Obama to raise the minimum wage. I think, as was alluded to earlier, it's been mentioned, but it's been a little bit of an ancillary issue. And I think if Occupy and these other protests had been, you know, as successful as they would have liked to have been, we would see these national political forces being more strident in terms of how they push this issue. But I think progress is being made, but it'll take a while.
Actually, Rue, to just follow up on that point you're making about Occupy Wall Street, this isn't, you know, this maybe brings another kind of lens into this conversation, but I was actually I was talking about this. I was on some Huffington Post live panel last week, and we were talking about the Tea Party and Occupy Wall Street, and this kind of point about, you know, Occupy Wall Street sort of fizzling out was made, and I pushed back in some respects because I think, as you're saying, I think that, you know, and as Matt's saying, that the kind of rhetorical shift, at least, that President Obama has embraced is very connected to Occupy Wall Street and kind of what's been happening in terms of that type of movement. But it also just seems to me that, you know, one of the reasons that the Tea Party obviously has been a more sustainable force than Occupy Wall Street is even if you take the most charitable view of the Tea Party movement, that it's not just a pure kind of astroturf corporate, you know, funded movement. And there is a kind of genuine kind of right wing populist tinge to it. Nonetheless, the practical policy effects, whether it's genuine or not genuine, corporate America couldn't be more happy with. Great. Like, you know, don't regulate Wall Street. Get rid of environmental regulations. That sounds great to us. With Occupy Wall Street, you're really, you know, you're advocating on behalf of people who just don't have power in Washington because, you know, fundamentally they don't have campaign money, it seems to me. And is this another case where that kind of like old chestnut of you need genuine, you know, campaign finance reform in some respects, or you know, we can't really get to the root of these issues? Is there some truth in that, or no?
Well, I mean, I certainly would support serious campaign finance reform. I think a lot of people would at this point, and it certainly would help. But I don't know if I would let Occupy off the hook quite that easily.
Mm-hmm.
I think they were in a somewhat more difficult position than the Tea Party because they're not advocating on the behalf of deep-pocketed people, and they're not going to get resources from those people. On the other hand, I think that they, by their singular failure to embrace any kind of real agenda, any kind of real organizing strategy, and any kind of relationship with the, you know, sort of traditional center-left, electoral politics, what have you, they pretty much shot themselves in the foot, and it was almost guaranteed that the influence of the movement would decay quite rapidly because they simply couldn't sustain a presence, and they simply didn't have anything for people to do that was very concrete other than camping out, and, you know, that ran its course. So, you know, I know they're still out there. I know they're still doing things, but let's face it, as a movement, you know, it's just really off the radar screen, and I don't think it affects people's thinking much these days.
Yeah. The final question on the minimum wage. Do you think that is there a more aggressive push on the state level where Democrats are in control on a state level, and are we going to start to see this happen state by state through pushing it through legislatures and ballot initiatives?
I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, I think that there is some of that out there already, and I think it's the case that given some of the gridlock we see in the nation's capital and difficulty addressing important problems like this one, that it makes sense to do it in the states, and we have increasingly robust state-level coalitions, sort of progressive coalitions, as it were, that work in and around a variety of issues, and I think they may be taking up this one and pushing it, and I think that would be all to the good. I think when, you know, you got to use whatever avenue you can to advance this particular idea, and as we were discussing at the top of the conversation, this stuff is just damn popular, so right. Why not?
Why not, indeed. Rue Teixeira, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, thank you so much for joining us today, and everybody go read his piece, Raising the Minimum Wage is a Political Goldmine at Think Progress.
Great. Well, thank you.
Thank you. Take care. So there we go, folks. I thought that was an interesting conversation in terms of obviously – We could have gotten into an Occupy Wall Street debate, but I don't think that was the direction to take the conversation in. I mean, it's interesting because I think that there are valid criticisms of Occupy Wall Street, certainly. But then it's also like, you know, part of the reason it fizzled out was because the protesters were like mowed out of their protest zone by the police with helicopters and noise machines and batons that, you know, that those sort of things plays a role.
Yeah, I forgot who said it, but yeah. It's perfect way to say it. Occupy Wall Street didn't fizzle out. They were crushed in one big blow.
Oh, they were driven out.
Yes.
Yeah. No, I think that's it's not at all an excuse for any mistakes Occupy Wall Street may or may not have made, but, you know, when you think about it, after the financial crisis, Occupy Wall Street was the first major social movement in America that actually was addressing the issue, right? Like the Tea Party went through this economic crisis, and the first thing they went is they were just, those damn unions, we need to get rid of them. Like the Tea Party was this complete non sequitur that had nothing to do with the causes of the crisis. And then the Tea Party, it came a little bit later, but it came in 2011. And you finally had a movement that was actually talking and pushing on what the actual issues were. And, you know, and I also, I don't know, I think that they, I talk about lack of focus, but I think they brought Wall Street corruption. They brought income inequality. I think they did bring those things to the table. And that's always going to be to Occupy's credit. And the stuff they're doing on a grassroots level, like protecting people from, you know, home foreclosures.
Oh, yeah. If we're going to even go beyond just the Occupy Wall Street movement itself, I mean, that movement, it created multiple grassroots movements, from Occupy Homes to Occupy Sandy, which was amazingly
Occupy Sandy needed. In New York City, just so folks know, outside of New York, after Superstorm Sandy, Occupy Sandy was more effective at delivering aid to people, helping people who were suffering from having their homes destroyed, electricity knocked out. NYPD cooperated happily with them because they were just so effective.
In some parts of the Rockaways and Staten Island, they were literally the only emergency relief even bothering to help those people there.
Absolutely. They were there on the scene before a lot of the major, you know, marquee organizations like the Red Cross. And that was huge.
To go even further, also with Rolling Jubilee, Strike Debt.
Absolutely.
I believe they hit over $1 million in debt just gone from all these people. And I think they chose randomly. I think it ended up being a group of people in Kentucky. Their medical debt just cleared.
Their medical debt was cleared. And I remember, you know, I was having a conversation with a friend at the beginning of the Occupy protests. And I said at the time, I said, however this turns out, this is like a greenhouse. This is an incubator. And a million, you know, a lot of things will come out of this that will, you know, fail. And a lot of things are going to come out of this that will succeed. Because the point of this is that people are meeting and they have the right basic understanding of what's going on, and great ideas and movements and practices and businesses and social movements, all sorts of things are going to come out of it like that. And they have. And in that sense, I think it's a huge success. Look, folks,
we're going to go to the better half.
We're going
to
go straight to the better half.
Maybe we'll build up some of these stories here.
Yeah, we'll build up some of these stories.
You freebies will get to hear what we're going to cover in the better half.
Yes,
but if
sir.
You want to hear us cover what's in the better half, you must join us there.
Yes. If you want to know, you must know the better half.
Well, actually, before we go into the better half, let's quickly just – we're going to get really into this stuff with the better half, the paying members who fund your free listening.
Yes.
But let's quickly just – give a little bit of a summary of these NSA revelations, because some big things happened over the weekend in terms of the leaks that came out. I mean, we have this one where the NSA was – previously we discovered that they were looking at the – I believe they were spying on the G8 summit, correct?
They had spied on the G8 summit, and then also really quick in 2000 – in the lead-up to the invasion of Iraq, which we also covered, the Bush administration was extensively spying and wiretapping senior UN officials.
So on top of that, it's come out that the UN headquarters in New York – was bugged by the NSA. And we're talking bugged in terms of being able to listen to dozens and dozens of conversations between embassies of other countries. We're talking UN meetings and video conferences being spied on by the NSA. This is unbelievable here. I mean, this is ridiculous in terms of just the – I mean, look at it this way. If a smaller country – a less powerful UN country was to do this, the UN and the countries that make up the UN would be outraged, and we'd be talking about how to kick that country out of the United Nations. I think
that everybody I'm sure a lot of spying goes on at the UN by everybody. I think the problem is, again, and we'll get into this more in the better half, is that you, just as I would say, there is a radical qualitative difference between, like, look, every country is going to spy and want to get extra information. That's part of the nature of how states operate. That's not an intrinsically good or bad thing. That's just the reality. And then there's some states like, you know, a Russia, for an example, where it's like we're not in the Cold War. They're not our enemy. But there are real, genuine strategic differences. And they're doing the same to us. And I don't have a problem with that. But when you saw how aggressively we're spying against the EU, as an example, or how aggressively we're tapping into the UN as a neutral platform, what you realize is that the whole justification for these really robust spying programs, which is like really specific security threats, really specific issues, how it just gets expanded and expanded and expanded, even in this realm. And that's, you know, that's what Sam has pointed out a lot. And on a more terrifying and comical level, like from the macro to the micro, NSA contractors and agency employees are also using these tools to try to keep tabs on girls they're into.
Let's put it this way: yeah. This isn't Michael's worst case scenario as it's been. To say that it goes further than just spying on other governments or agencies.
Yeah.
This isn't, you know, one or two NSA analysts or spies, you want to call them, gone rogue. This is so commonplace that there is a name for it within the NSA.
And we will get to that name in the better half of the program.
Yes.
We also have new hilarity involving Donald Trump. We also have Andrew Ross Sorkin's most obnoxious column to date, which is amazing. Syria, talk about what's going on there. We also have this really obscene article from the Daily Beast,
Matt
is going to break down.
Horrible.
So lots for you. Please, you know what, folks, if you became a member and specifically said you became a member because of Matt and Mike, that would help us in office banter, as well as helping to feed Sam's adorable children, which you all know about from the show.
I mean, as you'll recall, last week Sam looked at the membership after our plea the previous Monday, and he found that not only did nobody join, but two members quit. Not because of us, at least they'd said not because of us. It was because of financial reasons, job loss, but doesn't really look too good for us.
And as we all know that, you know, yeah, and we all know that pretty much everybody who listens to this show, probably about 70% of the audience, is a systems admin. And we know that can be, you know, there's insecurity in that market. But we also know that for those of you who are enjoying system admin jobs and, you know, IMing the show while you're dealing with, you know, major data sets and everything else, that those jobs can be pretty good. And you have an opportunity to support genuine, independent media like the Majority Report. So really, anything you could do. We also keep memberships up for people who've gone through economic hardship as well. So anything you could do to become a member, to join, and really when you break the price down, it's less than a cup of coffee a day. And it's an incredibly easy thing to do. If you're like me, sometimes you get annoyed, like, oh, I don't want to go through some whole long internet sign-up process. Nothing like that. It's easy, take you a matter of minutes, and you're also helping pay for this amazing new app, which is going to be available for everybody soon. And that way, and then listening to Majority Report is going to be like easier than listening to NPR. This app is so nice. I mean, we make fun of Sam for how obsessed he is with it, but it really is a nice app. So also follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook. We're going to be sharing a lot more YouTube clips and other fun things on Facebook. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, Just Coffee. Buy your coffee there. That helps us. Click the Amazon link and Majority Report FM, and buy your stuff through Amazon. Makes no difference to you, but we get a little cut. See you in the better half of the show.
Oh, also, donate your account.
And donate your account.
Follow us on Twitter, Facebook.
Well, I said all that stuff.
You did?
You just weren't listening to me.
I actually was reading something else. I apologize.
It's okay, amigo. We'll see you on the better half of the show. We'll be right back, folks.
that we'll pay.